Hello, and welcome to the National Park Service Southwest Archaeology Podcast, brought to you by the Southern Arizona Office. My name is Matt Gubard.
And I'm Charlotte Hart.
In this episode, we'll be talking about the Western Archaeological and Conservation Center, known by its acronym WAC. WAC is the Federal Repository for Objects and Archives from the National Park Service's Intermountain Region, which includes the American Southwest. WAC curates nearly 14.5 million objects and archives on behalf of 71 parks. And while their focus is our region, they can also assist park units in other regions as needed. WAC also provides a centralized space for scholarly research with diverse collections in one single location. We're talking today specifically about how WAC partners with parks, and then we'll get to an interview with Khalil Saba, who is the archivist at WAC, and Dana Senge, who is the senior objects conservator.
So I know I've talked a lot on this podcast about my experiences from back when I was a frontline ranger and the interpretation side of things. My first experience with WAC comes from that time period of being a frontline ranger and not having any experience yet of professionally working directly with objects or archives, but still interpreting them to the public and knowing how important they are to fill out the story, not just for archaeologists, but also our visitors. And so WAC, as the repository for the objects and archives of the Park Service sites in our region, and from where I was working in Southern Arizona, all the way up to Montana, it became like my Graceland. You know, I really had to see this place and what treasures it held. And I finally got that chance during one of their March Archaeology and Heritage Awareness tours one year. That's the only time of year that WAC is open to the public, and they have a few tours of the repository and the archives. Getting to be on that tour highlighted everything that I had built WAC up to be in my mind. A couple years later, though, I went back to grad school and I applied for and got the opportunity to be a graduate assistant in the archives division at WAC. And seeing WAC from that perspective of being an employee who came in and clocked out every day, it turns out that WAC is just another place that people work. That work that they do is super important and super helpful to the parks that they serve. And it's oftentimes hidden because I think we have put this sheen, just like I did originally, over all of these objects that they're conserving and protecting and preserving. And all of that is very important, but the day in and day out of that work is just as fascinating and isn't talked about as much. So I'm excited to get to our interviews today and give a behind the scenes listen of WAC for everyone today.
Okay, so this is Matt Gubard and Charlotte Hart. We're here with Khalil Saba, who is the acting regional archivist for the Intermountain Region Museum Services Program. Hey, Khalil.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so we have some questions for you. We want to learn a little bit about what you do here. We'll start off by, can you talk a little bit about what your job is and what the archival repository is here at the WAC, the Western Archaeological Conservation Center?
Well, I am the site manager for the archival repository, and my duties include I am the technical expert for a group of contractors that perform most of the archival duties here. So I oversee their work and I assist them with their duties. I also am responsible for research requests from the public and from Park Service staff who are seeking information on archival collections that we do store here. So I'm the lead in assisting with researchers in identifying archives and helping them find those archives.
So what are Park Service archives? I mean, what do they consist of?
The records we have here from over 60 national parks in the Intermountain West mainly contain what we call resource management records. So these are field records created by Park Service professionals or contractors in mostly the cultural or natural history realm. So we have the field notes and the final reports and the photos. We also have personal paper collections and administrative files from these numerous Park Service units.
Okay. So that's important for managers who are in the field, because that's sort of the continuity between all of the past projects and all of the things that are going on now or might go on in the future.
Yes, and the archives record the decision-making for a particular project or event or circumstance. Mm-hmm. So managers can go back and recreate and discover why a certain decision was made or why a decision wasn't made, for that matter.
Sure. Sure, and that's super important for instance, archaeologists in the field, because a lot of what we learn about how to do our jobs better comes from what people experienced in the past, particularly mistakes. And so we learn about how to do our jobs better by learning how folks did things right or wrong in the past.
And then you don't need to recreate the wheel. If you already know that somebody did a survey of an area that's going to be disturbed, you don't have to invest into that survey again if you know what was already there.
Right. All right. So how many archives are stored at WAC?
We have archives from approximately 60 Park Service units in the Intermountain West, and there's approximately 4.9 million items in the archives.
Wow. That's a lot. Holy cow. Okay, cool.
What does an item mean?
An item, well, and we, in the archives world, you record archives by linear footage. So one linear foot equals 1,600 pieces of paper.
Okay.
And it's a management tool. We have to report. It's a reporting tool.
Mm-hmm.
But in the archives world, you need to record it by linear feet. But to report to management, we have to record it by items, because the museum program is based on items, historically artifacts.
So an item could be a one-page memo documenting
a trip
report.
Yes.
A photograph.
Okay. An item could be a 100-page report.
Okay.
All right, so in the National Park Service, we think of protecting and preserving resources like archives in perpetuity, so forever. Can you talk a little bit about what that means for you guys? Because that's a really long time.
Well, for resource records, they can be revisited years or decades after the final study was done. So it's not uncommon for a researcher or park staff to return to a project that may have been completed decades ago, and they want to revisit the conclusions of that project. And maybe they have a new perspective of what those conclusions are. And so that is one of the most important reasons why we keep these records, is because that resource is still at the park, and the park managers still have to preserve that resource.
Mm-hmm.
So they always need access to these legacy records that were created. And they may find new and better ways to manage that resource,
mm-hmm.
even though they're dealing with records that are decades old.
So in a lot of ways, the archives, so for instance, an archaeological site, we think about preserving that in perpetuity as well, but there's sort of this whole other side of it. The archives are associated with the site, so they're being preserved together in a lot of ways as a package.
And they reflect the changes and the progress and the modifications to how that resource was preserved.
Right.
From 70 years ago as opposed to modern day.
Right, yeah. So that makes me think of in the parks, often the bookstores will sell what are called administrative histories, which are, of course, a record of the way that a resource was managed over time. Seems like it would be really boring, but it's not.
And that is ultimately the value of the archive, is to have a body of records that reflect that evolution and change.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just one event that took place at one time, you're looking at a whole evolution of a management policy.
Right. So what excites you most about this job?
Discovering resource records that park staff didn't know they had is probably one of the most rewarding things, because a lot of times these records get shoved into attics and basements and outbuildings, and staff doesn't physically have access to it. And then when we come in and do a survey and organize it and describe it and give greater access to it, it's rewarding to see staff say, oh, if I only knew about this, or I didn't know we had that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rewarding to me because it's making their job easier, park staff jobs easier.
Mm-hmm. So is there something in the collections that you have a particular affinity for?
Well, probably it would have to be the Little Bighorn collection, the Elizabeth Bacon Custer collection and associated records. This institution has been working with Little Bighorn for over 20 years, and I've been to the park dozens of times, and so I probably have an affinity to the 7th Cavalry and the Little Bighorn archives.
So can you, is there something in that collection that you could describe to the listeners that you think is really interesting?
Well, what's interesting is we have a large portion of Elizabeth Bacon Custer's personal letters. So you can see the evolution and just the history of the decades that she survived after the battle and the correspondence she had with other generals and the general public and newspapers. And you really get a sense of the perspective of where Miss Custer was coming from.
Interesting. Wow. Interesting.
Does that change your perspective on the preconceived notions you had about the battle or about Little Bighorn at all?
Well, she was an advocate for the general, and mm-hmm. so it's there. It's clearly a one-sided story from Elizabeth Custer, and okay. it's clearly there, and that's not a surprise.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, and that's a good example of sort of changing public perceptions, right? Because now we try to incorporate other perspectives.
The Native American perspective.
Particularly Native
yeah.
Americans, and that's, so you kind of get the other side of the story, which didn't always happen.
For decades.
Yeah.
Yes. For decades, it was a one-sided telling of that story.
Right.
Based on a grieving widow.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Fair enough.
So, can you talk a little bit about what preservation is in the National Park Service from your perspective?
Well, I mean, it all starts with the Organic Act. And then from that flows the legislation for legislating these Park Service units. So the archives is intimately connected to that resource. Even though it may say in the legislation we're protecting this ruin, by default, those archives are attached to that ruin. So even though there are legislations that say we created this monument or park because of the archives, but those are few. Those are few and far between. But the fact that the legislation says you will protect this historic landscape or these Native American ruins or these historic barns, you can't decouple that from the archival record of those resources. Be it whatever they are, natural, cultural, and for the public to do research. We are open to the public on a reservation basis. So,
right. Okay. So, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because listeners, particularly in Arizona, might be.
So we do cater to particularly the work we do is a historian will have a contract to write administrative history, but we are open to the public by reservation. And you have to have a specific topic or need. You can't come in and just say, I want to browse archives. There needs to be a reason why you want to look at a particular document or you have a particular topic to look at.
Okay. Okay. So in addition to kind of giving folks a behind-the-scenes view of what the Park Service does, I think we also want people to feel like maybe they can help participate in preservation. So is there anything that listeners can do to support archival preservation?
The most important thing for the public to do is be involved when the National Park Service or the Department of Interior is asking for comments on a particular policy. It's important that the public weigh in on that particular issue. That's one of the most important things, is the public to be involved in the scoping period or the open period for comment, because okay. the powers that be need to know that the public is involved and engaged in whatever that may be, whatever policy that is, or whatever comments that the government is seeking. It's crucial that the general public get involved and voice their opinion.
Okay. Cool. So we asked this question to Dana yesterday. So in your job, you're focused on preserving archives. Does what you do at your job, does that affect your personal life? Are there things that you do at home that sort of mirror what you do?
Oh, of course. Like my siblings, I'm the default to digitize and organize the, the family papers, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but beyond that, it's kind of the cobbler's children have no shoes. I need to be more organized at home with my paper records than I am here at work.
Yeah.
I think we all agreed that that is how we all behave at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So thanks for talking with us, Clue. It was great.
Yes, it was my pleasure. Yeah, and enjoy your parks.
Thank you. So I think it's really important to highlight something that Khalil said in that interview. He responded to one of Matt's questions saying that to have a body of records that reflect the evolution and change in park management is the whole point of archives. And I think that that's something that I didn't necessarily realize as a frontline ranger, and certainly learned when I was in grad school and an archives intern, is that we're not just saving every scrap of paper that the park produces. That would be unimaginable. But showing how the management decisions on how we preserve places is vital to the continuing management of those places, so that we can learn from our mistakes and essentially make better mistakes the next time around. So that was the archive side. Let's hear what Dana has to say about conservation at WAC. So Matt Gubard and I are here today with Dana Senge, who's the head conservator at Western Archaeological and Conservation Center in Tucson. And the Western Archaeological and Conservation Center is a place that supports our parks throughout the Intermountain region. So we're just going to talk with Dana and find out how she supports our parks. So Dana, tell me about your job.
Well, thanks, Charlotte, for inviting me to do this. My job is to lead the conservation team and contribute to the Museum Services Program here at WAC. And we have the building hosts the conservation facilities for the region, which is a really wonderful thing that we have to support our parks. So we have a couple of conservation labs, and we have a team of specialists who work directly with the repair and care of artifacts. So my job is to lead on those projects and to work directly with a lot of our parks to understand the needs and help get to their preservation needs.
Nice. And before you were the lead conservator, the head conservator, you were the assistant conservator. How was that job or position different?
I was a little more directly involved in implementing the projects. So project management, but also doing direct conservation treatments and teaching maybe more often our conservation technicians, as well as getting a little bit more into the longer part of projects with our park staff.
Nice. So artifacts and the archival documentation that goes along with them are stored here at the Western Archaeological and Conservation Center at WAC for what's called in perpetuity, mm-hmm. which means forever, essentially. And that's a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of folks, they might think that once an excavation or discovery is done, that's the end. But your work really starts there and lives in that kind of end space for the rest of us. So
mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that, or can you speak to that?
Well, it is a hard thing for a lot of people to remember when they want to use artifacts that they're thinking, I want to put this on exhibit, and they're not thinking about the length of the exhibit or what that exhibit conditions will, how that will affect the object. So I do come into this every once in a while. And what I tend to go to is 100-year cycles. And we kind of think that way in conservation. I hope other conservators will be okay with me saying that. That we try to think about, okay, what I'm going to do, how is that going to last the next 100 years, and will the next person be able to remove what I've done and change it once new materials are available and new technologies out there. So one of the things that I've been able to tap into is the centennial and say to people, we have this after 100 years today, and we're trying to preserve it to the next, the bicentennial, and kind of think about it in those chunks. And sometimes people get a little closer to understanding the in perpetuity, which is a little bit harder to quantify.
Right.
But we can't make a decision today that will last for in perpetuity. what I can do today only lasts a little while, and it may be 100 years, but if you say in perpetuity, 100 years is only a little while. Right. But the materials that we use to store objects and to repair objects, they do deteriorate with time. It's just we're trying to select things that do that very slowly and in a way that isn't going to be harmful to the object when we have to remove the material from the object or the object from the container or something like that.
Right. So something you just said reminded me that back when I was a park ranger at Tuzigoot and we put in the new museum that after your lab had done a lot of work on the pots there, we showed the cracks and the voids in these artifacts where we didn't have necessarily a piece to make the pot whole. And so what we would tell visitors when they were asking about the pots or if we had a program about them, that the conservators who had worked on the pots in the 1930s and put them back together with really hard glue, that they were doing the best they knew how at that time. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that still holds true? Or
I think that's a very fair way to say it. I think we commonly, as human beings, I'm not going to throw all the conservators under the bus, but everybody kind of looks at the past and goes, what were they thinking? And I often sit in the lab going, oh gosh, what is somebody going to say about me in 50 years' time? We are doing the best we can with the information we've got and the materials we've got right now, and which is why we try to test, now we try to test materials to see, we'll put them into artificial aging situations to see how they could be reacting over time. And there is an advantage now to testing materials that I don't know that we had 50 years ago or was thought of doing 50 years ago. I have to say, I don't even know what was available to test those materials 50 years ago. Right. So, or 100 years ago. Well, we are very fortunate that the materials selected for a lot of those pots, for example, was very reversible. And so even though it degraded and it weakened, which meant that the fragments or the sherds were starting to collapse and the pots were starting to fall apart, we could safely remove all of that material and put new adhesive in. So we were very fortunate with that particular material selected. There's a lot of other odd ones out there that we run into. But
I imagine those make for interesting days in the lab when you don't know what's in front of you.
Well, yeah. We try to do a lot of testing before we even start, but there are times when something, our little spot tests on a material aren't giving us as accurate of information as we think, and we'll be in the middle of a treatment and discover we misread the information we were gathering earlier and misunderstood, and we're in for a battle. we're really just in for a lot longer treatment than we estimated.
What are you working on in the lab now, or what is your staff working on in the lab now?
We have four projects going on in the lab right now. We're just wrapping up a really big project for Yellowstone. They have a map that in the Mammoth Hotel that is was made in the 30s, and they were doing renovations in the hotel, so they took the map down and brought it down here to WAC for some cleaning and some replacement of coatings and that kind of stuff. So that's been a really neat project to have around. And we have some prehistoric ceramics getting treated for exhibit. We have some historic silver that's being cleaned and getting ready for exhibit. And then we have ethnographic material from the Grand Teton collection that's a wide range of cultures that were brought together for that collection. And we have been treating that one for that group of material for about a decade. So we've got about 100 more pieces out of that collection to take care of. So we're pretty excited to have gotten this far, although it's a beautiful collection to have in the lab, so we'll be sad when it's done as well.
I have to say, your lab has windows to the hallways so that visitors and the rest of the staff can see a little bit of what you're working on, and it's been very nice to be able to look in and see these very colorful objects come through. It's been very nice.
Yeah, they're a treasure, and a lot of people really appreciate having got to see them through the last decade, getting their treatments done.
Will they be going back on display?
There are a few pieces on exhibit at Grand Teton right now, and those were actually recently, one exhibit came down and a new one went up. And there's a rotation schedule. I'm not exactly sure of the timing, if it's like a four-year rotation. But so about 100 objects at a time are getting up on exhibit up there. And the park is working on some other stuff, so I don't know if in the long run they'll have larger exhibits or not, but we have an active program with the curator up there.
Okay. Can you tell me what a rotation schedule is and how your lab helps with one?
Yes. There are objects, some objects are more sensitive to light damage than others. Light and heat start off deterioration reactions. If you remember high school chemistry, that is commonly what can get a reaction to go. And so we're...
It's also in the fire triangle for any wildland firefighters out there.
There you go.
You need your heat.
We're thinking about this in a less extreme situation. However, it's something that we use as a guideline in exhibit planning and thinking about how long is something going to be on exhibit, what is the environment of that space, and what is the intensity of light that's hitting that material. So some pieces, dyed quill work, for example, on ethnographic objects from Grand Teton, they're very beautiful, very vivid, and we don't want them to fade any further than they may have already faded. And so we recommend short exhibits at low light levels, so 2 to 4 years, depending on the situation, and at about 50 lux, which is 5-foot candles, if anybody's interested. And that helps us slow deterioration, and that's something that I often am talking about, is saving those materials for the next 100 years and so on, so not only we can appreciate them and learn from them, but our grandkids and so on. To your original question of what is an exhibit rotation plan, in designing an exhibit these days, we are trying to understand, can we rotate, do we have enough objects of similar, that tell a similar story, that we can create a rotation plan? So sometimes it's very specifically designed at the beginning of the exhibit, and other times it's just knowing that in 4 years we need to change the exhibit and rotate it off. So at Grand Teton, it's completely changed by the curator. To bring in another park, Tonto National Monument has a set exhibit that has, we've identified rotation groups that will tell the same story of in the textiles exhibit. So we have 3 plain weave textiles that are similar size that can all fit in the same slot, and we can take one off and put the other one on, and we have a cycle for that. So
that's an incredible amount of planning.
It is. I actually have a calendar that goes out 40 years for that particular, because the last exhibit, I think, was up for about 40 years. So I don't know if we really want to admit that.
They were doing the best that they knew.
Feel free. Right? Well, and feel free to take any of this out. But what I feel is that we were doing the best that we knew. We know better. We can't do better. And that's part of the challenge in the Park Service, is I think a lot of us are fighting, or not fighting, but we're trying to find efficient ways to do better. How can we actually make sure that's not a 50-year-old exhibit?
Right.
Or doesn't last for 50 years. And my best effort was to make it an exhibit rotation instead of saying you have to change this in 20 years, because who's going to be around to remember that, and are we going to have the funding and that kind of stuff?
Right.
That is a challenge.
So the world that you work in is kind of like you've got the knowing. Knowing is half the battle, so mm-hmm. now you're in the second half of the battle of being creative. So in all this work that you're doing with helping parks come up with rotation schedules for their museums and just caring for the objects that are in storage until they're maybe rotated out, I've heard you before talk about customer service when you're talking about parks and the curators at parks that you're working with. So why do you use that phrase?
Well, I think about it a lot as all of the parks are our clients, and we're here to hear what they know, hear what they're concerned about, and then match what we know to what they know. And I think part of it is, I use it a lot when I'm talking to my staff to remind them. We're not in charge. We are the reference. We can recommend, but we don't make decisions, actually, in conservation. We're here to be a reference to everyone else, but the curators make the decisions about the collections. That's my understanding of our setup. And so I really use that a lot to just kind of remind people what we're here for, and really an attitude to go out to talking to the parks is not that we swoop in with all of the knowledge, that we swoop in and we learn a heck of a lot and then we provide some information to augment what's already happening and what people already know. We have a real diverse body of knowledge in the parks, and I'm learning every time I go into the parks so much, not just about the museum collections, but how they fit into the parks and how people have been able to care for them, and movements of preservation within the Park Service. So how we used to try to teach and put the tools in the park staff hands, and then what I'm inspired to do today based on what was successful 30 years ago, and how I'm going to want to try to explain something today, or just recognize that it's hard to keep a program going as our park staff move around the country.
Nice. So do you find that you're essentially working with a team that's really integrated, but a different team every time?
A lot of times, yeah. And I think that the other role that we play in conservation is trying to be a bridge of information. So not just recognizing, we did this way with this park last year, but now we have a whole new curator, so I can give them some information that I from the last curator that I learned, and then within a few months' time, they're going to be teaching me a whole new group of things because they're seeing a whole different array of issues because they have a different body of knowledge. And
wow!
So it is a lot of learning and sharing, but
cool.
Rather than just walking in and teaching, if that makes any sense. The difference to me there. So
no, it does. I think another thing from back when I was a frontline ranger was that we used to say, you know, science isn't dead, and a lot of kids learn in school like that this is how chemistry works, and so because they're given static ideas and laws of physics essentially, that science is static. So maybe not science is dead, but science is static,
mm-hmm.
and it's not.
It
is always evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, and so not only is the field of conservation always evolving because it has a lot of science in it, but also just how successful we are in each park at our preservation activities changes as the different staff comes in and out and different restrictions exist or are lifted. So you're always in flux.
Cool. So how often do you get to do research on the collections as well?
Rarely. I would say never, except for you brought a research project to me recently. That's the first research project I've really done with collections. In conservation, we do some research related to materials to be used around collections. So we do take samples of materials that we're curious about to see how well they... if they cause reactions with metals, which is a good indicator to us that they could be corrosive or otherwise damaging to other materials. So we do a tiny bit of research in that area. And the other thing that we are trying to do is not just understand the materials that we're using, but then how easily we can help people implement them. So we might come up with a solution that if you had a conservation lab at your disposal at all times, you could complete very successfully, and then we'll try to come up with a solution that if you don't have a conservation lab at your disposal at all times, you can go and buy things off the shelf and construct. So,
which is especially useful for most of our parks that are 30 miles away from the nearest grocery store.
Yes, and that.
What excites you most about your current projects?
Honestly, helping parks. I get really excited when we get to go into a new place and learn from a new group of people what's been going on, and then start to help understand the priorities that we see from conservation and how those can marry with the park's priorities, whether it's just the museum collection priorities or the greater park. And then starting to help achieve those. Of course, I think a lot of us are excited by the new.
Great.
I have to be honest that I get excited there too. And then, of course, being successful at that and actually getting through a project and having truly been able to help. That's pretty cool. So.
Nice. Is there an artifact that you have a personal affinity for?
I get excited. I will honestly say I get excited about basically the last thing that I was working on.
Mm-hmm.
We have some really incredible collections here at WAC, some prehistoric material from the Southwest that I get very excited to look at. And there's some fragments of prehistoric textile that I find, having worked in weaving in the past, I find really fascinating to look at. And then, of course, the prehistoric ceramics, some of the design work on those is just stunning. So I love it when we pull those materials out in particular.
Nice. Are there any collections or even just a symbol artifact that really strike you as being a good example of the preservation movement that you were speaking to?
Sure. We have in the... I can actually speak to something where I was around for the beginning of, so the... in the early years of my being here, and I've only been here for just over 7 years. So in 2010, I was part of a couple of surveys of museum collections that we were able to understand the need of the prehistoric ceramic collections and then start to seek funding. The National Park Foundation got excited about the data we had gathered and wanted to help us seek funding, so they started to also do some fundraising, and we have, through their help, been able to actually start addressing some of those treatments.
That's great.
One of the things about prehistoric ceramics, as we've kind of touched on it earlier, I think, too, they were reconstructed by archaeologists to learn design, form, and a lot of work was done to them, but those materials are aging, and in some cases, those pieces are starting to fall apart on the shelf. So a sherd might fall and hit another part of the pot and damage it. It might hit another pot and damage it. So there are reasons for us to actually go in at least to stabilize those materials. And so it's great to do that to minimize harm. I also love that we're preserving what somebody did 100 years ago to learn. And we, of course, are learning more from that as the conservators. We're not necessarily changing the archaeological knowledge, but... I like that we're kind of doing a twofold there in preserving its original, it's not original state, preserving its, preserving what's left of the object, but also preserving the Park Service's impact on the object too.
Right, definitely. And how has that project progressed?
We are, we've been able to treat, I think, 30 of those objects, if I remember correctly. We have hundreds to treat, so we're still seeking money for that through various sources. So.
Excellent. How do you prioritize objects when you have hundreds and money to treat 30?
It really does depend on the situation. The first thing we're going to do is, if it's actively falling apart, that's the first thing we really want to treat.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes exhibit comes into play. So we might have 50 that are actively falling apart, and 10 of them we want to put on exhibit. So those 10 will be the first 10 mm-hmm. in the group. So it really is balanced with the needs of the park, and that's really the decisions that we make in what is going to be treated and when and what money is going to be spent on conservation really is not just from the conservation perspective, it is weighing in these other the other issues from a curation perspective. What is the history of the piece? What is the significance to the park? The significance to academia, I believe it is appropriate to say. And then, of course, do we want to put it on exhibit? And so we're going to be prioritizing based on that. So I'm usually saying to a curator, here's my urgencies. And then they're going to say back, okay, I'm going to skip over 3, but we're going to go 1, 2, and 4, and 5 or something like that.
Okay, so. Right. How can our podcast listeners learn more about preservation and what you do, what conservators do?
I think there are a lot of online resources for learning more about preservation and conservation. One of the things that may be helpful to keep in mind when one of the podcast listeners is at a museum, is to understand the light levels are low for a particular reason, or understand why we're choosing the materials we're choosing. Some museums, I haven't yet seen a park do this, but that doesn't mean there isn't one, may have an adopt a object program, mm-hmm. and you could contribute a little bit of money to preserve that in one way or another. And so I encourage you to not feel like it's a lot of money to help, but if you want to put a little something towards something a park is working towards, or a museum in general, that is a way to support the preservation of doing so. And there are some things out there for preserving your own treasures. So there's some websites out there to even just, I think one can just search for conservation of cultural heritage and start to understand. There used to be a book, like Preserving Our Own Treasures, or Preserve Your Treasures, or something like that.
Nice. So. I think the website for WAC also has some of those links that you're mentioning on it, so yes. We can redirect our listeners
Thank
there.
You.
Yeah. Definitely.
I have a few that aren't on the list.
Let's go.
All right. So WAC has probably, hundreds of thousands of objects mm-hmm. in the repository, representing thousands and thousands of years of history. For me, so I spend a fair amount of time here, but for me, one of the more interesting objects was Custer's jacket.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things, why it's so interesting is because I had this picture of him in my head, which was based on, in part, being a kid and reading about him or seeing, you know, depictions of him on television. And I was surprised by how small the jacket was, how sort of demure it was, yeah. and how ornate it was. And it was very different than what my idea of him was. So are there any objects that you've worked on in the past that have sort of changed your opinion about a group or a person?
Well, your story brings to mind a very similar experience of mine. Prior to working with the Park Service, I ended up working on one of Elvis's jackets.
No way!
And it was the same exact thing. It was much smaller than I anticipated.
Was it like a rhinestone?
It was not. It was from his early years.
Okay.
So anyway, I know that's not completely related, but it is one of the first times when I went, whoa.
Well, it's interesting. I think it speaks to the importance of conservation, because the actual objects can help you to understand the people that they're associated with in ways that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
That scale in a picture can't quite relay.
Right.
Yeah, right. I think the objects specifically that are so similar to what we might do today are the ones that are most affected with that. Mm. So clothing, and then of course utilitarian items from around our lives. One of my favorite places to work was actually up in Alaska, because you get to start to see solutions, problem solving from the cultures that is so different but is so so successful. If you were to compare contemporary boots to boots made a few hundred years ago with the different skins and that kind of stuff, or even just the different stitches that people came up with to live successfully in such a remote environment with access to such different materials. I love that, to see that contrast. It's one of my favorite things. So.
Interesting. I think another question I had is, so you've spent your career conserving these objects, oftentimes historic objects, which, like you mentioned, are very similar to the things that we sort of have in our houses. How does your job affect the way that you curate your own objects at home, or the way that you take care of things at your home, or does it?
It doesn't fully. I will admit that I have been unofficially named the family archivist, so I have taken care of the family things, but I also, in my downtime, I make art, and I break the rules. I glue it together with stuff from the hardware store instead of making my own glue like I would in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I kind of save it all up for here, and I tend to be a little bit more. I run into things a little bit more outside of the building than I do in the building. It's like I save all of my precision up for being at work, and then I'm a little less precise. So
That's funny. I have the printouts of the sonogram photos from my baby that I should have put in sleeves, you know, being trained as an archivist, I should have put in sleeves a year and a half ago. And they're still just on the fridge because, you know, that's where I get to see them. Yeah. And I save a lot of it for my work.
Yeah. I will say that I chuckle at myself more than one might because I know that I'm doing it. But I'm probably no better than anyone else in taking care of my personal stuff.
Well, Dana, thank you so much for talking with us today. This has been an awesome discussion, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it.
That's great. Thanks. So the general public might sometimes think of artifact conservation as occurring right after an archaeological excavation, which it certainly does, but there's this whole other side that Dana really did a good job of illustrating that's much more long-term, thinking about how to protect artifacts when they're in the repository, in part so that future archaeologists can study them in greater detail and understanding how to rotate collections in museum exhibits. All things that are really important to understand and are part of historic preservation at large.
Definitely. I think that both Dana and Khalil today really exemplified some of those hidden parts of historic preservation that aren't necessarily out in the open or shiny, but are essential to what parks do, and without their help, parks couldn't, you know, complete the cycle of historic preservation.
Thanks for listening today. The U.S. map made of different woods that Dana described is now back at Yellowstone National Park and up in the Mammoth Hotel. Plan a trip to see it for yourself. We're looking forward to our next episode where we continue our conversation about historic preservation.
The National Park Service Southwest Archaeology Podcast is a production of the Southern Arizona Office of the National Park Service. Our artwork was designed by Laura Varen Burkhart. Justin Mossman composed our music. We look forward to hearing from you. Matt and I will be with you again next month.